Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm Jeff Greenwald, writer, artist, and photographer, and tonight we're talking with Mary Roach. Mary is fascinated by the salacious, obscure, and titillating fringes of science and ventures into topics where others fear to tread. Mary's recent best-selling books include Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Spook, Science Takes on the Afterlife, and most recently, Bunk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. Please welcome our guest, Mary Roach. I have to say that in looking at your book on Amazon, I was sort of overwhelmed by the positive number of reviews. I think there are a total of about 87 reviews, and about 85 of them are positive, and there are two negative ones. And there's a wonderful line from one of the negative ones that I wanted to share with the audience. The information in this book is mostly trivial or useless, and there's not enough of it.
I love that.
The frankness in your book, in Bonk, is absolutely disarming. You have a marvelous way of making the most taboo subjects seem conversational. I know that you were born, correct me if I'm wrong, when your dad was in his late 60s?
My dad was 65 when I was born. That's right.
Well, who in your family educated you about sex, and were you always so at ease with the subject?
No one in my family educated me about sex. I think in third grade, my best friend Heidi Klunder's older brother Hans took us aside and sat us down in the kitchen and told us the facts of life, none of which I believed for a minute. My parents never had a thing to say. My mother in her 80s actually brought up sex for the very first time, and it was a kind of an awkward thing because I'd asked my mother how come there's 6 years between my brother and myself if you were a practicing Catholic and not using birth control, and she just blurted out, "Well, your father always had difficulty maintaining an erection." So it was,
ouch.
And that was really the first time I'd sex as a topic had passed between my parents and me. Yeah,
I know it's impossible. It's too bad you couldn't have read this book. There are so many wonderful cures for that.
I know it's sad.
You know, my feeling reading the book. I don't know about anyone in the audience, but I remember when I got a CD player for the first time. I just want you to go out and buy all my favorite albums and listen to them again on the CD player because they'd sound so much better. After reading your book, I felt the same way about my old girlfriends. I just want you to go out and make love to them all again because I felt I'd learned so much about how to make them happy. One of the things that you mentioned in the book that just is quite fascinating is how the position of the clitoris and how far it is from the vagina
right.
directly impacts the position you should use and the kind of stimulation a woman needs during sex. And some women have gone to pretty great lengths to...
so to speak. There's a chapter in the book about the distance between the clitoris and the vagina. And there are a couple of people looking into this. There's a guy I met at Emory who's doing some research, but he got interested in it because of this woman, Marie Bonaparte, who was Napoleon's great-grandniece. And around 1915, she published this extraordinary paper. She wasn't a medical doctor, but she managed to get this paper published. She herself was a very... she thought of herself as a very sensual woman, but she always had difficulty having an orgasm during missionary position intercourse with her husband, and was convinced that it had to do with... she herself had a long span between the vagina and the clitoris. She actually broke women down into three categories. She herself was a téléclitoridienne, which translates from the French as she of the distant clitoris, which I thought was a lovely way to say it. So
very
much nicer
poetic
than frigid.
How far is that? How far is that in I guess, in centimeters?
In inches, it's about an inch is average, and then much over that would be the teleclitoridienne, and then there was the paraclitoridienne, which is the lucky woman whose clitoris is situated very, very close. Interestingly, in animals, in pigs and in cows, the clitoris is inside the vagina, which is excellent engineering, I think.
Is it lucky because if your clitoris is closer to your vagina, you have orgasms more easily through the traditional missionary position?
That's right.
And what about for the, para clitoridiennes?
My
French is a little rusty.
Paraclitoridienne, yes, the woman, the more tightly packed woman. Mm-hmm. In other words, everything's situated close together. It's just simpler because the clitoris would be receiving indirect stimulation during intercourse, but if it's, the clitoris is very close, it would be easier to get it involved in the action a little bit. But the sad thing, Marie Bonaparte, she found a correlation, and she was convinced that this was the problem. There are two things going on with Marie. Her husband was gay, probably contributing in some way to problems in the bedroom. And the other thing is that she had a little bit too much of the Napoleon Bonaparte determination in her. She went out and had her clitoris surgically moved. Gasps from the audience. And it did not help her. You just wanted to take her aside and say, try another position or use your tongue or something.
Well, she was kind of like the Michael Jackson of the clitoris, wasn't she? I mean, she had it moved several times.
Twice,
yeah.
That's a nice way to put it. I like that. The Michael Jackson of the clitoris.
And Mary, may I ask, what are you?
Of course, very few people. Because you're my friend, I guess you feel comfortable asking me in front of a crowd of strangers and thousands of radio listeners. I am a mesoclitoridienne, right about average. I know, of course, because when you get information like this, you run home and get out. I got my husband's Stanley Power Lock tape measure and a mirror, and I left it on the bedside table, and Ed said, "What were you measuring?"
you mentioned pigs before and how the pigs are extraordinarily sensitive. Does the fact that a pig's clitoris is inside its vagina, I can't believe I'm asking questions like this. It seems like I've gone native in some strange, island culture.
Join the club.
Does the fact that a pig's clitoris is inside its vagina give them greater sexual pleasure? Do pigs experience sexual pleasure?
Oh, yes, they do. Of course. Because it's directly stimulated during intercourse. I mean, it's right in there. So, yes. And the reason we're talking about pigs, it may be sort of a mystifying thing, but here's the reason. I traveled to Denmark for one of the chapters that the pig actually, when there's artificially inseminated, in Denmark, the inseminators were sexually stimulate the pig because they believe that that an arousal and orgasm would facilitate conception. This is sort of off on a different topic, female orgasm conception. And conception. So we're heading off sort of in a different...
Well, that idea that orgasm actually facilitates conception,
right,
is the and I think you say in your book that makes really good intuitive sense, that since a man has to have an orgasm in order for certainly to ejaculate,
yes,
in order for conception to occur, it made sense to the ancients that a woman would have to also.
That was
proved to be not true. But does it actually improve the chances of conception?
Well, there's animal research that suggests that it does. There's in a lot of different species, including the pig. And that's why the Danish government, in their wisdom, came up with the five-point sow stimulation plan, which is actually a list of things that the inseminator does that kind of mimic what the boar does to get to arouse the sow. And the boar, of course, uses his snout, and the inseminator, lacking a snout, will use either his boot or his fist. But it doesn't look like foreplay in any way, shape, or form that you and I would recognize. It would, you sort of have the sense when you walk into the barn and see this that it's kind of some odd Monty Python sketch. It's not.
You do mention one thing that is kind of fascinating, is that pigs are the only mammals besides humans who like to have their breasts fondled during lovemaking?
Yes, the boar is the, other than the human, the boar is the only male that stimulates the female's breasts. There's not a lot of, there's no other species, pigs, humans. That's it.
So do animals, now I know a lot of studies on sexuality have been performed on animals because it's so difficult to get, well, funding or subjects.
Yes.
To perform them on humans. Do animals, I don't want to spend the whole evening talking about animal orgasm, and we won't, but I'm just curious to know about, do any animals express themselves during orgasm with the sort of abandon that humans do?
You know, that I had that same question when I was in Denmark, and the inseminators were doing their arousal routine, and I said to the woman who was hosting me there, Anne Marie, I said, you know, I look at this female pig, and she just seems utterly bored by the entire proceedings. She doesn't seem to be in any sort of a, you know, the throes of abandon or ecstasy, and she cautioned me to make any kind of assumptions because she said, animals don't show pleasure and pain on their faces. They don't register pleasure and pain in the same way. They, in dogs and in pigs, the ears tend to be very expressive, but the lower face is not. So that kind of deadpan look that the sow had might have, to another pig, translated to, she's digging it.
One of the things that you talk about quite a bit in your book is the whole issue of male impotence and the many things that have been done to sort of change that and work around it. And I think as a man, though the procedures themselves were often harrowing, involving some kinds of surgery we'll talk about later, one of the most harrowing things I read about in your book was the fate that befell, was it French men during the late 16th and early 17th mm-hmm. century, when impotence was actually a crime?
Yes.
Can you explain how impotence became illegal?
Sure. There was a... there was a period of time when marriage was a sacrament. It was considered it was a man's legal obligation to consummate his marriage, to be able to perform sexually. And if he couldn't, then it was considered grounds for divorce. It was illegal. When you could get in trouble, you'd have to return the dowry. There are all sorts of consequences. And so women would tend to use this as a way of getting out of the marriage. And what ensued was this horrible thing called the impotence trial, where these judges and people with clipboards and magnifying glasses would all gather around the poor man's bed and say, okay, pull back the covers and let's see what you've got. And they were just these horrible descriptions of these poor men. Some of them would like hire a burlesque show to kind of like get him in the mood and arouse him. Others would try to sort of, you know, slip their hand in and kind of, put pressure underneath it, and see, yeah, it's it's perfectly erect, and it was so. It was, and it went on for centuries.
Aside from the divorce, was there any actual penalty or punishment for impotence? Like, did they hang you?
And sadly, that would have produced an erection. it wasn't a capital offense, but it was a humiliation more than anything else. And then it at a certain point it went a step further, where the man not only had to prove that he could get an erection, but that he could maintain it long enough to have sex with his wife. So there would be the two of them in the bed, and the man trying to, you know, in some cases sort of, you know. Anyway, they were at cross purposes, and it was just this kind of farcical routine, and they were being observed the whole time.
Fortunately, we live in more enlightened times.
Yes.
One of my favorite characters in your book, and I just have to say the characters in the book are just wonderful. I got such a wonderful picture of this Taiwanese doctor named Dr. Su.
Dr. Su, yes.
Pronounced H-S-U, who performs a very specialized kind of operation where he actually removes certain veins from the penis, which prevent drainage of blood out of the penis and thus help men achieve and sustain erections. And you actually witnessed the surgery?
I did, yes. And Dr. Su is a remarkable character because this is a procedure that has fallen out of favor here in the U.S. There was a period of time where some urological surgeons here were doing the technique. As it turns out, a couple of years down the road, the body tends to regrow veins. So then the procedure stops really helping. But, I mean, it is helpful for a couple of years, but it's certainly an operation no one's going to get without first trying Viagra to see if that helps. He's a remarkable guy. I walked into the operating room or to his clinic, the Microsurgical Potency Reconstruction Center, I believe is the name of it, and he had an acupuncture needle sticking out of his head, and he was operating with wraparound shades. He's just an eccentric guy. He had problems with glare. He'd had a stroke some years back, and he found that the glare bothered him. But he just had these dime store wraparounds. And
you're going to be a little eccentric if you're going to spend your life operating on penises that way, I would think. Didn't he have some weird directive that he had given the local hospital?
Yes. He was not only a surgeon. He did a tremendous amount of anatomical research into the penis. This is a man who lives to know the penis. And he had this standing order at the...
Many men are like that, I hope.
He had this standing order at the anatomy department of the local university, where they do dissections. He had a standing order for them to save the leftover, save all the penises for me. And he told me that he was still chagrined to this day. He had this box with something like 17 penises in a freezer, and someone threw the box away. he would use them for dissection to, mm-hmm. say, figure out what the venous structure of the penis.
Right. What a waste.
That is.
The one thing that you talk about for both men and women is that one of the simplest and most effective cures for a lot of kinds of sexual dysfunction, whether responsiveness in women and responsiveness in men, are these exercises called the Kegel exercises. Now, I'd heard of these Kegel exercises in terms of that women would use them, but I didn't know that there were also Kegel exercises for men. Could you describe these exercises a little bit to the audience? I'm actually demonstrating them right now. And also explain why these are not taught to grade
school. Me too.
This is one thing that the live audience can appreciate just as much as the radio audience. Yeah. One thing I didn't understand when I read about these exercises and their amazing efficacy for so many ills,
yes.
that have to do with the bladder and the prostate and the vagina and that whole everything down there, is that they're not taught to grade school students. They seem so. Why don't you talk a little about the exercises and what they do?
Well, sure. Yeah, Kegeling is really just it's an isometrics exercise. In other words, you're squeezing the pelvic floor muscles. Mm-hmm. These are the muscles that you would squeeze to if you're needing to stop your stream of urine. That's basically the what you're doing. And originally they were Arnold Kegel. Or Kegel was the man who pioneered them, and they were originally for incontinence, because if you're having trouble with urinary incontinence and you do your Kegeling exercises, which just amounts to squeezing and relaxing over and over many times a day while driving, while sitting watching TV, whatever, that you would have a better time of it. Incontinence-wise, but then what he found out is that the women were coming in and saying, well, it's the darndest thing, but I'm able to have orgasms now, and I never was, I'm having them more easily, and it's a great thing. So Kegel sort of took this on the road and preached the litany of Kegeling far and wide, and now they're sort of known as not only an exercise for incontinence, but for sexual pleasure. And there's actually a device, it's like a super Kegeling device. In other words, Kegeling is isometrics, where you're just squeezing, but if you did weight resistance training with those muscles, man, just imagine what kind of sex life you could have. And there is this device.
And you actually have with you a vaginal
dumbbell. It's a vaginal dumbbell. It's the feminine personal trainer. It's right.
Let's have a look at it. I'll describe this for the radio audience. It looks like it's about 3 inches high, and it looks like sort of like a bowling pin. With one end just slightly smaller than the other, or one end slightly bigger than the other. And what do you do with this device?
Okay, basically, you would start out with the larger end.
This
is for women. So you'd start out with the larger. You'd start out with the larger end up, and you would essentially insert it. You would squeeze and sort of lift it up and down and down. And then when you got really good at it, you'd flip it over and you'd have the heavy end hanging down, and you would have to try to hold that in there and squeeze it and lift it up. So that's pretty advanced Kegeling.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure third graders are ready for that.
Probably. It's a very odd. I tried it once, and it's kind of like giving birth to a doorknob. I mean, to a door. It's like, it's a...
What do you use it for now?
I use it as a paperweight now. It's actually, it's quite substantial.
So was there anything, you did such thorough research, I'm sure there are many things that didn't make it into your book. What was the most surprising thing you learned about your own body?
Oh, there were a tremendous number of little facts that you'd think that you would know about yourself. For example, women have nocturnal erections. I did. Who knew? I don't know. Maybe some of you knew. But obviously they're clitoral. They're mm-hmm. they're not penile. And they're on the same sort of cycle that men have them during the night, which I thought was the parallels between the penis and the clitoris are kind of remarkable. They both have little erectile chambers. They both have the little, you know, foreskin. There's even, I don't think it's not, they both get erect. So it is kind of a, you know, you could say that the clitoris, the penis is a very, very large clitoris. I was going to say the clitoris is a very, very tiny penis, but then I switched it.
Yeah, that's very appropriate. Which sort of brings us, let's just touch very briefly on the subject of female ejaculation, which is still a mystery, isn't it, in a way? Nobody really knows what it is.
Female ejaculation, that is the, actually, I think that's the most common question I get asked at events, is what's going on with female ejaculation? It's obviously not semen. There's a debate as to whether it is urine or whether it is something else, and there's been 5 or 6 or 7 studies, and in some of them it's determined chemically to be urine, and in others it's not. So it's kind of an open question.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you a personal question.
Yay!
I want you to lean over and smell my wrist.
Okay. Yeah, that's cologne, right?
No. I wondered if it had any effect on you, any arousing effect on you. Do you feel yourself kegling?
Is it androstenone?
No, it's this. Let me show you what it is. I went out and if I can find it here in my, oh, this is was supposed to be much easier. Yeah, it's it's this cologne called Realm. That's supposed to have human sex pheromones in it.
Right,
and
yes.
And supposed to make you very attractive to the opposite sex. It hasn't worked for me so far, but I wondered if it might. Now, I actually, to tell you the truth, this was a birthday gift from my sister about 5 years ago, and I haven't used it until tonight because I read in your book, you actually mentioned this particular perfume, and you say, okay, Realm is made, and I'm quoting from the book here, made from, it's actually quoting a guy named Preti. George Preti. Made from skin compounds derived from scrapings off of the inside of casts worn by injured skiers. My first question is, what did they break?
It's leg casts. George Preti works at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. He's quite an expert in this area. He parted ways with a coworker, Winifred Cutler, who began selling cologne with this additive that was supposedly a human pheromone. And she claimed to have a study that showed that men who added this substance to their aftershave were seeing an increase in the number of, how often they were having sex or dating. I forget what the exact parameters were, but anyway, that's where she and George Preti parted ways because he didn't feel that she had substantiated it. I actually tried this because they have a male and a female version, and for a salon column I wrote some years ago, I tried the stuff, mm-hmm. and it's interesting because the effect that it does have on you is if you're wearing it and you're curious as to what it's going to do for you, you are constantly looking around. And making eye contact, you know, like looking at people to see if they're checking you out. And that, of course, makes you seem to be checking them out. And, you know, so I think probably those men were seeing more action. I mean, I think that it's effective as a placebo.
You know, E.O. Wilson, who did all those wonderful studies on ants, I heard him recently on a Science Friday broadcast, and he was making the point that whereas humans are extremely visual and auditory, we get almost all our information about the world through our eyes and our ears, many animals don't rely on eyes and ears at all. They're completely scent-based, pheromone-based.
Yeah,
ants particularly.
Chemical communication.
So how much of the I mean, we've all heard about pheromones. We've all read about pheromones. We all like to believe that we exude pheromones in certain situations. How important are human pheromones in sort of attraction and mating and bar hopping? And
they're extremely unimportant. I mean, we don't really have pheromone. I mean, a pheromone is a chemical signal. I mean, it like you were saying, it's for species that don't have any other form of communication. They're very specific things that are communicated, like bees give each other information via pheromones, not sex pheromones, but direction pheromones, location pheromones. And sex pheromones, well, here's an example. In the boar, okay, if the boar, when the boar produces this material, he gets this frothy saliva that hangs down on his face. And in that, very attractive. But it contains androstenone, which is this substance that if the female is ovulating, if she's in estrus, she will become receptive. Just boom, receptive. You can inseminate her, whereas otherwise she would throw you off her back if you're an inseminator. So the inseminators, in order to figure out which sows are receptive, they have this, it's kind of hysterical, it's named Skippy, and it's a plastic replica of a boar, which doesn't really look
Skippy?
Like... Skippy? Yeah, it's an acronym for something, I don't know. S-C-I-P-P-Y. Anyway, it's this fake boar on wheels that you can do by remote control, and he makes... So he has an MP3, so he's kind of grunting like a boar, and there's this... They spray him with Boarmate, which is a synthesized...
Boarmate?
Boarmate. You can buy Boarmate and have fun with it. Mm-hmm.
Boarmate. I think I'd rather buy some Boarbegone.
Boarbegone, yeah. In the next aisle. But he exudes Boarmate, and that's enough for the females. Never mind that he's this sort of, you know, clunky, unattractive plastic thing with making a ridiculous noise. That chemical, irregardless of what he looks like, it's all in the chemical, whereas humans, primates, are more attuned to, just a lot more sophisticated.
Sort of like money for the human male.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's see, where are we here? What are some of the great mysteries that are still remaining in the world of sex? What are some of the things that are still really unknown and undiscovered?
That whole issue of whether or not female orgasm does in fact boost conception, the odds of conception. Nobody, and that's amazing to me that isn't a known thing. Masters and Johnson, in their lovely way, Masters and Johnson were amazing in that there was no experiment too out there for them to try and get subjects for. They got interested in this whole, the theory was upsuck, which says that when a woman has an orgasm, the contractions of the uterus will suck the semen up through the cervix and quickly deliver it to the egg, thereby boosting the odds of conception. They didn't buy it, and they actually came up with this experiment with women who they put a cervical cap on them with artificial semen, mm-hmm. and a radio opaque dye so that it would show up on an x-ray, and they had the women sit in front of an x-ray machine and they took x-rays right at the moment of orgasm to see if they could see the stuff being sucked up, which isn't amazing when you think about it. You got people to come into a lab and...
How could there be sucking if there was a cup there blocking
it? That was the criticism of the study. They found no evidence of upsuck. Other people wrote in and said to them, well, that's because you are interfering with the suction because of the cap. Mm-hmm. So very good.
So there's no real knowledge of whether or not that...
So it's an open question still. There mm-hmm. is, like I was saying before or earlier, there is animal evidence. That's why the inseminators in Denmark are doing their interesting sow stimulation plan. But so in animals, it does. I mean, there was a 6% increase in the number of pigs born when you practice the 6-point or 5-point, I forget, sow stimulation plan. But in humans, no. It seems like that's something it would be worthwhile knowing.
So there are a lot of mysteries about the mechanics of sex. But what about with things like arousal? I mean, are we learning more about why certain people are attracted to other people? I mean, if pheromones are not in the mix, often you see people together, you can't believe they're together.
Well,
there must be something going on there that doesn't meet the eye.
Well, I have a chapter in the book that has to do with hormones. And people know that there are male and female sex hormones, but I was unaware of the role that they play unbeknownst to the person. In other words, when a woman is ovulating, when she's able to get pregnant, There are all these studies that show that women will masturbate more, they have sex on their mind a lot more, they will initiate sex. I mean, if you go into a rhesus monkey enclosure and you, the females have nothing to do with the males 99% of the time, but when they're ovulating, all of a sudden they're like, they're right there next to the male, they're slapping the ground in front of them, they're like, hey, look at me. And with people, it's a little more subtle. But I think, like, but this research, he said, you know, he and his colleagues would go to bars and sort of watch the behavior, you know, like the woman who goes up to the jukebox just at the same time as the guy is up there. And there are things that you're doing as a woman, specifically, well, I'm just talking to myself, you're doing things that you don't see it as. I'm trying to pass on my genes. You don't interpret it that way. Right. But if you look back, if you were have a calendar of where you were in your cycle and who you slept with, I think you'd see some interesting parallels.
Well,
hormones are kind of nature's three bottles of beer.
You know, it's often been said, talking about, just sexual arousal and aphrodisiacs, there's quite a bit, of course, about aphrodisiacs in the book, that intelligence is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Have there been any studies done on this? And if there haven't been, how do you think you might set one up?
God, intelligence
That's a tough
is
question.
I don't think anybody's looked into that. Intelligence as the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Is that just a myth that smart people tell each other?
Exactly.
I kind of like the idea of a study on that, though. You know, one thing that you mentioned when you were writing your book in the middle part of this decade, 2006, 2007. You mentioned several times it was very difficult for sex researchers to get funding in the very conservative political climate. Now that we have a completely different administration, do you think this is likely to change? And what kinds of studies might get funded now that didn't get funded before?
It'll just become easier to do studies like that, the whole issue of the distance between the clitoris and the vagina, studies that have to do with sexual pleasure and investigating ways that people can feel, you know, ways to make sex better. Mm-hmm. In other words, sex, if it's associated with reproduction and fertility, it's always been very easy to get funding. But once you stray from that and you look at sex as a source of pleasure and personal well-being, then during the Bush administration anyway, you would sort of set yourself up for trouble. So much so that researchers would sometimes would change not use the word sexual or any word like penis or clitoris in a title or a proposal, because those can be searched by keyword on the internet. Mm-hmm. And that way these people were sometimes targeted by very conservative elements of the religious right.
They must have jumped through some verbal hoops to get around some of that terminology.
Yeah, just they'd use the word, you know, physiological instead of sexual. Mm-hmm. There's this sort of rash of very, very vague projects out there that would, or they would get a big grant to study for something related to fertility and then siphon off some of the money to do the stuff that they were more interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So there were ways to get around it, but I think that's going to, you know, it'll certainly be easier now.
So you were part of a study in London. One of the things that's so wonderful about your book and about you as a person is that when something interests you, you often just jump in with both feet or other parts of your body if necessary. In the case of this study in London,
Dr. Deng.
What was the name of his study? And he was trying to create what they call four-dimensional images of coitus.
That's right.
In other words, three-dimensional images in real time, also using the element of time as the fourth dimension. Tell us how you got involved in that study and kind of what that was like.
Sure. Well, I had heard about this man's work. He had published a paper in The Lancet that had to do with he had done one of these scans on an erecting penis, his own, as it turned out. And he envisioned it as a technique that would help a surgeon who was doing surgery for Peyronie's, where the penis, erect penis, goes off to one direction. It can be quite painful. And, I mean, something that men who have it seek treatment for. And so that was the reason he was looking at sort of a scan being helpful to the surgeon to see exactly what was going on prior to surgery. So he was sort of trying out this technique, and that had worked. And so he said, well, now let's look at, for my next project, he actually mentioned in The Lancet, I'm going to be doing a scan of genitals in sexual congress. I don't know if that's exactly how he put it.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but is this an MRI scan or is this?
No, this is an ultrasound. This is ultrasound. This is actually with the wand pressed to the body. Okay. MRI would be better in a sense because you'd have the privacy of the tube. Whereas in this case, the guy is right there holding the wand. So I wrote to him and I said I'd really like to be there for this historic undertaking. You know, you're the first time you've done any sort of a scan like this. And he wrote back and said, well, we're having a little trouble getting a volunteer. And if your organization could provide a brave couple for intimate study, we'd, you know, be happy to arrange one. So my organization asked its husband. And I brought it up, yeah, not in a completely straightforward way. I think I said, you know how you haven't been to London in 25 years? And how would you like to go? And I'll pay for everything, and we can go see some plays, and we have to have sex in front of a researcher, and then we'll go to Stonehenge. And So that's how it happened.
So, okay, what happened?
Well, it was, people, here's the thing. I it would have been great to be able to, to be an observer would have worked well, but first of all, I wasn't getting any volunteers, and second, if he had gotten volunteers, to get permission to be in the room would have been awkward. And I really did want to address that curiosity that everybody, including myself, has about what is that like to be a subject in a study that involves two people having sex with a researcher in the room. And I can answer that question now. And it really was less like sex than like one of those awkward procedures you go to the hospital to have, and you know it's going to take 15 minutes and it'll be done with, and then you'll go have a drink. It was that kind of thing. I mean, obviously the burden of performance was on my husband, Ed.
Mm-hmm. I love the part in the book where you write that here you are both in the hospital room and you're wearing this gown, and they give him a copy of Maxim to get him aroused.
Yes, Dr. Dang, actually, he hands it to, it's a brown, so you know, a plain brown envelope, and he hands it to Ed, and he goes, this is very arousing. So Ed takes it out, and it's Maxim. Yeah. But yeah, we were wearing those just incredibly awkward, dorky little Johnny's tops with the open back, and so it was, and Dr. Dang was a very, I mean, if you have to have sex in front of any researcher, I have to choose Dr. Dang, because he was such a, he somehow made it seem like, this is just a normal thing to be doing. And he was twiddling his knobs over, I mean, his machine over there. And, and Ed sort of joked at one point, well, where's the soft light, the candles and soft music? And Dr. Deng, I mean, he was just such a straight guy. He said, oh, I'm sorry, I have on my laptop, I have the soundtrack to Les Mis.
So did he film this? Did he actually film this? And have you seen the film?
It's on the internet. Remember, ultrasound is just very grainy. You know what an ultrasound film of a fetus, or a heart beating. It's like that, and it's just really this area right here, well, for the radio audience, right around the belly button that he had the wand. So he's essentially just imaging the genitals.
Mm-hmm. So there's nothing very titillating about it.
So it's not terribly. It's the most G-rated, X-rated footage you'll see.
Did you come across anything in the book that was so so provocative or politically charged that you actually felt like you should leave it out?
Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. I didn't come across. There's a scene that was taken out of the book, not because it was politically charged, but just it was a little too. It had to do with when I went over to Cairo to visit Professor Shafik, which is a researcher who looks at reflexes, and he had done some work on reflexes, the reflexes of sexual intercourse, like when the vagina distends, it triggers a reaction in the pelvic floor muscles, which might serve to press on the dorsal vein, which might keep the penis erect. All these sort of Rube Goldberg theories that he had. He was a very eccentric man. And I went over there, because he was going to do a demonstration of these reflexes, and his female volunteer just fled about an hour before, and I don't blame her one bit. But so he had enlisted some guy from, a nurse from the OR to demonstrate some other reflexes, and it really didn't have anything to do with sex. Of course, I wrote it up and put it in the book, and my editor took it out wisely because it had to do with the anal wink reflex, which is an interesting reflex, but we don't really need to go into it.
I just want to remind the audience that in about 5 minutes, we're going to start taking questions. So if you do have a question for Mary, please, you can start lining up by the mic right now. Mary, in writing this book, do you feel subjectively that your experience of sex has improved and become more pleasurable?
That's a good question, Jeff. The only change I guess I noticed along the way was when I was reading Human Sexual Response by Masters and Johnson, which is that book that came out in 66 that covered all the things that happen in the male and female body through the early stages of arousal to the later stages through orgasm. And they're talking about the earlobe swelling and the salivary glands becoming more active and the vaginal barrel expanding and all these, this cascade of things that are happening. And you can't help but, when you're reading this book, become a bit of a spectator in your own bed. Just kind of going, oh, is this the part where the earlobes swell? And that was sort of distracting to me, and I'm glad that phase is sort of passed. But that was really the only real effect that the book had on me, other than the fact that my husband and I just, I was always talking about my work, so we spent a lot of time talking about the nitty-gritty of sex, which I think is always a good thing for sex.
Yeah, well, personally, I have to say I was a little frightened to read the book because I was afraid it would sort of bring this kind of clinical, medical vision of sex into the bedroom, and I think it actually brings a very playful component into the bedroom, especially if you've got that measuring tape with you and you can start speaking French to each other.
That's right.
So do you feel that, I just want to return to one thing that that we brought up before, just in terms of the kegling. I'm really fascinated by this whole kegling thing because it just seems to, we didn't talk about it for men, mostly for women, but it also has wonderful effects for men. What do you think it would take to create a society where kids could be taught, as frankly about sex as you write about it in your book?
I think it's maybe with Obama in office, it's possible. I mean, certainly. But I don't know. Remember when Jocelyn Elder was she was the head of the health department under Clinton, and she was the one who said that masturbation is something that was healthful, and it is. And this is, she said, this is something that maybe should be taught in school. Well, that was the end of Jocelyn Elder. As one researcher reminded me, she said, not realizing that what she was saying, she said, Mary, masturbation is a very touchy subject. So I'd like to think that it's something that's possible, but, if it couldn't happen under Clinton, I don't know. You'd think.
So let's see, where are we here? I wanted to remind the audience that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, and tonight's guest is Mary Roach, the author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. And are we ready to go to the audience for questions at this point? Are you ready to take some questions?
I am ready.
Okay. I see there's a questioner up there, a lone questioner. Please.
Hi. Big fan. Here from Denver, actually. I lead
a book
club, and we've read two of your books in the past year.
Thank you.
Virginia Johnson's nephew was very resistant to give you any information.
Yes.
I'm sure he gets a lot of calls from a lot of quacks, probably. I didn't know if after you finished your book, if you sent it to him, and if he softened up at all, or...
Scott Johnson, actually her son. Scott Johnson, not a welcoming person. I have not heard from Scott Johnson, did not send him the book. Sent him some of my earlier books, trying to convince him that he should talk to me, which may have actually been the problem. There is a Masters and Johnson, there's a biography coming out, I think it's out now, this week. And I talked to the author, and I said, what is up with Scott Johnson? And he said he had had a similar experience, and that even after Virginia herself had agreed to talk to him, Scott Johnson tried to turn him away at the door. So I'm not sure what the story is with Scott. Virginia Johnson is quite elderly and hasn't been entirely well lately, so I understand why she didn't want to speak to me. But no word from Scott, no.
You know, there was a question I forgot to ask you that I'd like to ask you now that I see it on my pages of questions. After looking at all these studies and speaking to women who are having all these tests done and so forth, where do you weigh in on the orgasm? Do you believe that the mythic vaginal orgasm actually exists?
Oh yeah, there are clitoral orgasms, vaginal orgasms, nipple orgasms. There are eyebrow stroking orgasms. There are toothbrushing orgasms. There was a woman who would reliably have an orgasm every time she brushed her teeth. People are wired in all different manners. As for
when you brush your teeth, where's the orgasm?
It was actually the motor sensory process of toothbrushing was triggering a small seizure in the part of the brain that's involved with orgasm. And this, she was completely flipped out by it. Sought medical help. They couldn't do anything. She switched to mouthwash for her oral hygiene. I think the vaginal orgasm issue, that comes down to semantics in a way. Are people talking about a G-spot orgasm, or are they leaving the G-spot out of it? And when you have vaginal intercourse, you're also involving the clitoris, especially if you're a paraclitoridienne, going back to, if you have a very closely situated clitoris. So absolutely there are vaginal orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
They're going on right now.
In
thousands
this very
of
room.
This very room.
Along with a lot of kegeling. Oh, sir.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a question about when you're beginning your books, whether they be about sex or about corpses, how you sort of identify the right people to talk to and convincing them to talk to you, maybe before you have books to send them to sort of justify that you're legitimate.
Right. Well, I identify them. I begin by just sort of doing a very, very broad kind of an internet search by putting in the words, say, for stiff, cadaveric. That would sort of get you the people doing research. Or go on PubMed, which is this database of all the medical journal articles, and put in, penis, vagina. That'll find you the people doing sexual anatomy studies. Then I would send emails to these people, and I don't know how this, before the internet, doing this kind of work was so hard, because the internet enables me to just write a letter sort of explaining what I'm doing, that I support what they do, that this is my goal, I'm hoping to find out what they've got coming up in the next year, and could I come visit. So I spend a lot of the first few months just endlessly writing emails to strangers, some of whom reply, and some don't. Does that answer your?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
Have you formed lasting relationships with any of the researchers you've worked with on this book?
Yeah, I'm actually good friends with Cindy Meston, who runs the Female Sexual Psychophysiology Lab in Austin, and I'm in email correspondence here and there with a couple of others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's one of those people you mentioned who. Needed to hide behind the rubric of fertility studies in order to fund her actual passionate work.
Right. Down in Texas, I guess it's a little difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was the work that she actually wanted funding for?
Oh, she does work. She studies with women in particular, with female arousal. There's a disconnect between the body and the mind. Mm-hmm. you can document an increase in genital blood flow, but if you interview the woman about her subjective feelings, she may not even notice it, or she might not interpret it as feeling sexy. And so so when you're trying to find drugs that would increase libido or sexual arousal, it's not enough just to get a drug that boosts vaginal blood flow. You would actually have to get something that makes the woman think that it's working. So, and that's a tricky thing, and that's a specifically female conundrum.
Is there a... Oh, okay, over there.
Hi.
Question.
Thanks for speaking. I was wondering, having been to so many different countries, was there an experience that you could share with us that was interesting for you as an American woman that you didn't expect a certain interpretation or experience from a woman elsewhere or a male?
I guess I was in mostly just... It was London, Denmark, Cairo. And Cairo was by far the... to me, that was a fascinating place to visit, just because, you know, for sex research, you know, this sex researcher couldn't do openly do his work. He published only in other countries, in Europe and the U.S., and he had to pay sex workers to be subjects. No one would come and participate. But I was speaking to a reporter there who was doing an interview that day, and she was talking just about how when Professor Shafik, who's one of the few people who actually openly talks about sex there in Egypt, when they would have people, you know, they would encourage people to ask questions and email their questions, people would open a whole separate Hotmail account just to ask a question. I mean, it was kind of a sobering realization of how sort of, you know, how far we've come, I guess, since the 50s, and how not far other places, or how far backwards they've gone. So.
Thank you. Sir?
You have a wonderfully light style of writing, and having written some science myself, I know it can be deadly dull. How did you, what's your writing history that brought you to this particular way of writing?
Well, thank you for the compliment. I think partly it has to do with the fact that I don't have a background in science. So I am speaking to I'm pretty much at the same level as my readers for the most part. I'm starting out at the same place, so it's easy for me to know when I'm, to recognize if I'm getting too jargony, you know, or too technical. So I think that that might have to do with it, but it's also I also have a very short attention span, so I don't delve too deeply in any one area because I've lost interest by the time I would get that deep. So that may also be a part of it.
One of the most wonderful things about your book, I have to say, are your footnotes. Whenever you feel like really just sort of flying off on a tangent, you'll just write these footnotes, which are just completely abstract. Millard Fillmore's last words.
The Millard Fillmore. I got called on the carpet for that one. The Millard. Usually they are at least related to sex in some way, but the Millard Fillmore one was, yeah, I don't know. I lost my mind for it. But the footnotes are fun.
Footnotes are wonderful. Yes.
I just didn't know if you could share with us what topics that you're exploring next, and also didn't know if you brought Ed so we could applaud him and thank him for going to such an extent for your work.
Absolutely.
I actually have the same question about your next book.
Oh, okay, great. Well, let's start with, Ed is here, and I think you should, you know, Ed, stand up and everybody applaud for Ed. He's right there. the next I'm writing about, the next book has to do with astronauts and all the roachable aspects of living in space. So that's what I'm working on next.
Roachable, you've invented a new adjective.
It just kind of is, it sort of explains, rather than trying to sum it up in any other way.
One thing you said that just before the last question that was really interesting is that women can be aroused without knowing that they're aroused. Is that sort of the import of what you just said?
Well, women can, yeah, if you define arousal by an increase in genital blood flow, which is how sex researchers tend to define it, and when they're testing drugs, that's often how they'll define it, you can get a significant increase in genital blood flow, and if you ask the woman, she'll be like, what? I don't know, what are you talking about? I didn't feel a thing. Or, yeah, I felt something, but I didn't feel sexual, I didn't feel horny, I didn't feel... You know, I did notice sort of that I felt, an increase in warmth or something, but it doesn't necessarily translate. Whereas if a man has an erection, it's pretty obvious that he's aroused. I mean, there's not very many men who'll go, what do you mean I'm aroused? I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, this was a very charged topic because women could respond sexually to rape without actually being aroused or being engaged in the act, and yet their body will automatically respond in ways that... You know, on a conscious level, they have no desire to respond at.
Yeah, that's true, and that's actually been an issue that's come up in court cases where the lawyers for rapists will try to use that to their advantage. And there was actually a paper published on that saying that should never be allowed because it can be this just automatic response that doesn't in any way translate to anything pleasurable. Mm-hmm. So, that is a charged topic.
Are there any more questions? Please line up at the mic or just walk to the mic and we'll call you right away. Yes.
I have a question about stiff. There was the woman in Sacramento, I think, who brought about our law against necrophilia by kidnapping the corpse and having her away with it.
Yeah, yeah. What was her name?
I don't know.
You'd think that I would know. Yeah, it'll come to me anyway.
Well, the question is, how exactly did that come about? Did this involve popsicle sticks or what? I can't quite figure the corpse, the dead man, and she's having sex with it.
Oh, now I see what you say with the popsicle sticks. Okay. That's a good question. I do know that embalming has a sort of plumping effect on the male genitalia, I'm told. So sometimes, if you donate your body to science, you will at least be able to impress the people who dissect you. You may be larger than you were when you were alive. But anyway, good question. I'm not sure what Karen Lee Greenlee, is that it? I think that might have been it. I don't know the particulars of what she did and how she did it, but good question.
It seems that after all your research, you kind of come back to this point of realizing that for all the science that's been done, sex really is not about almost any of these clinical trials, that it's in humans at least, it's a much more mysterious and global phenomena. So is that something that you think many researchers would also agree? For instance, most astronomers, back in the early day, were criticized for taking the mystery and the romance out of space, but they'll be the first to tell you they're as awed by outer space mm-hmm. and the moon and stars as anyone.
Right.
Do sex researchers, do you think, feel the same way about sex? Are they doing it because they're awed about it or because they're obsessed with it in a different sort of way?
Sex researchers are sex researchers, I think, because they are biologists and psychologists who simply had the good sense to choose an area of specialty that is endlessly interesting. I don't really think, my sense of them is not that they're unusually obsessed with sex or perverse in any way. I just think that they find it as interesting as anyone else and have figured, hey, I could make my living doing this. Wouldn't that be fun? But as to whether it takes that, I think, their research is their job, and I think like people who work with cadavers, they're very adept at leaving it at work, and they don't. I don't get the sense that they are bringing it into the bedroom with them, that it has destroyed their, the romance of it or the magic of it in any way, because they tend to be so focused on their one little avenue of research.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to ask a question here? I mean, I have endless questions, so I'm very happy to go on, but I'd love for somebody to come up and ask another question. Okay, I'll ask you one more. Oh, no, here comes somebody. Good. Hi.
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 The synopsis for tonight mentioned paraplegics being able to have an orgasm. Did you have any particular stories about that, or does it just kind of go back to
I spent some time in the University of Alabama in Birmingham. There's this remarkable researcher who studies orgasm, and she works with people with spinal cord injury. And, she counsels. She's one of the very few people in this area who actually addresses the issue of sexuality. And obviously, with a spinal cord injury, your sex life changes completely. And no one would talk to these people about it. She's one of the first who actually counsels them. And she's involved. She does orgasm research. It's a little technical to go into right now, but there's a whole chapter on her work and stuff that she does, which is fascinating.
If you were going to go into sexual research, what field do you think you'd choose?
What field? See, I wouldn't. I just want to be the person who dips their toe in for a couple years and then runs away and does something else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I don't know. What would you do?
What would I do? Gosh, it certainly wouldn't be anything involving those monkeys. I think watching monkeys have sex all day probably would not be that interesting to me. I think I know what I'd do. Have any studies ever been done about the higher mammals, like whales and dolphins, and their sexual response?
Yes.
What do you know about them?
Dolphins, dolphins are very sexual creatures. They're actually, this isn't in the realm of sex research. This was actually something relating to a completely different area. But they're male dolphins will come on to swimmers sometimes, and so those swim with the dolphin programs, they've sort of quietly dismissed the males because they're a little too frisky. So there, you asked me. There you go.
Yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask, in your research, is there any one thing that you noticed that men didn't seem to understand about women or vice versa? Any misconception that...
Oh, how really, much time do you have?
What did you seem to find was the most pervasive misconception that the genders had between...
Well, I won't speak for myself. Masters and Johnson did this really interesting study in the 70s. It was really the only study I found that looked at sex qualitatively instead of quantitatively, really. And they were essentially looking at gay and straight and long-term and just hooked up couples, and basically looking at who has the best sex. And the people having the best sex were the long-term committed gay and lesbian couples. And one of the reasons, as this gets back to your question, one of the reasons was gender empathy. In other words, two women or two men instinctively know what feels good. Whereas, and this was in the 70s, hopefully we've come a little ways since then, but the heterosexual couples, Masters and Johnson described them as kind of goal-oriented and sort of mechanical and saying, I've heard that if I stimulate her here for this amount of time, this will do that, and then she'll be done. And then it was kind of, rather than losing themselves in the whole experience and getting caught up in it, they were a little more mechanical about it. But that was, that was the 70s. But I didn't do surveys of couples, or I was really just more on the laboratory side of it. So
those people read the wrong books.
Yes.
We have time for one more quick question.
Yes, I read your book, and there was some very strange research or studies done in San Quentin Prison by Dr. Stanley.
Leo Stanley.
Yes, could you elaborate on that beyond the parameters of what was put in your book?
Yeah, there was a period of time when it was like mid the 50s and 60s when there was this fad for rejuvenation. Rejuvenation by testicular grafting. In other words, taking strips of testicular material from primates, goats in one case. There was a guy out in Kansas who was using goats and actually surgically implanting that into the scrotum as a cure for erectile dysfunction, or just generally to make men rejuvenate them and make them younger. And in one case, it was a Dr. Stanley at San Quentin who was actually using testicular material from freshly executed inmates. Yeah, yeah, that was a very strange chapter in the whole, in a very strange world. That was a very strange chapter, but anyway.
A strange chapter in here, too. The testicle pushers, is that the name of it?
Yes, the testicle pushers, yeah, yeah. But I contacted folks at San Quentin, and they kept promising to find me some stuff in the archives about Dr. Stanley and never came through. So all I know is from his published papers. And he was claiming just all manner of, everything was cured by testicular grafting, acne, memory, not just erectile dysfunction. But of course, you know, the inmates were being, you know, I'm sure they were getting a reduced sentence or something. They were motivated to say, God, I feel great. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really not the most trustworthy population as subjects.
Well, Mary, it's been just really great to talk to you this evening, and I want to sort of close this up by summarizing the book in your own words. This wonderful line at the end of the foreword, or in the middle of the foreword, that to me just really summarizes the delights of this book. And Mary writes, "This book is a tribute to the men and women who dared, who to this day endure ignorance, closed minds, righteousness, and prudery. Their lives are not easy, but their cocktail parties are the best."
Thank you.
Let's give a big hand to Mary for her thoughts tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.